This is Voyager Revisited, a podcast on the Incomparable Network dedicated to the Star Trek Voyager series. I'm Jean McDonald, and for each episode, I invite a Star Trek fan to come and talk about Voyager. And this week, I am talking to Shelley Brisbane. Hey, Shelley, welcome to Voyager Revisited.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very glad that we get to chit-chat about Star Trek and Voyager in particular. But before we get into that, why don't you tell the listeners a bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I host a podcast on The Incomparable called Lions, Towers, and Shields. It's about old movies, not old Star Trek, but just old movies.
Not yet.
Very little overlap, except every once in a while, and I'm probably going to try and make it happen on purpose. Every once in a while, there is an old movie that features somebody from Star Trek. Lions, Towers, and Shield episodes that an episode that includes Ricardo Montalban. Not a Voyager actor so far, but
no.
I do some other podcasts. I do a show called Parallel, which is about technology and accessibility. And I've been a Star Trek fan for a long time, since I was a kid. The Star Trek original series was in syndication when I was in junior high and high school, and mm-hmm. I had a close friend that was sort of my Star Trek buddy, and we both watched TOS together, and we even bought the James Blish Star Trek books with the synopsis of the episodes. And so I sort of was aware, continued to be aware of Star Trek, and then later Star Trek, sorry. And when TNG came on, I watched that. I remember feeling about TNG that it was sort of a comforting Sunday night thing to do before the work week. So it was something mm-hmm. my husband and I shared at the time. And then when Voyager came on, I watched some of it. I didn't stop watching it on purpose. It was just a matter of there was a lot going on in my life, and I wasn't really watching a lot of television. And having discovered Voyager again a lot later, like in the past few years, I'm like, oh my God, what was I thinking? Why didn't I watch Voyager when it was on? Because it's so good. Like I say, and the idea that there was, that Janeway was a captain, and I even knew who Kate Mulgrew was before Voyager.
Ryan's Hope,
from
by
Ryan's
any chance?
Hope, yeah. Well, and I'm also, somewhat later, I'm a Katharine Hepburn fan, and she did that play T at Five. That's controversial in the Katharine Hepburn fan community, not because of Kate Mulgrew, but because of the liberties that are taken with Katharine Hepburn's life. But I think Kate Mulgrew does a game impression of Katharine Hepburn, which is probably the only way you can play her.
Yeah.
But so I was sort of like, I felt like she was swirling around in my brain as somebody whose work I knew. But for some reason, like in real time, I did not watch Voyager to the end. And then later on came back and it was sort of great to discover a Star Trek that had been out there all along, but that I had not dug into deeply. So I'm really enjoying rewatching it a lot.
Oh, that's great. I mean, my theory is, you know, for myself as well, a lot was going on in my life when Voyager was on. I didn't really watch it. I mean, I barely watched it. I just was aware of it, even though I had been a Star Trek fan as a kid. But the new Star Trek, new as of 30 years ago, was...
This is how old we are,
Jane. Right, we're very old. coincided with when I was in graduate school and when I got my first job and things like that. And so it was stressful time, and I should have watched Star Trek, but I didn't really. You know, the other problem though is like it's on once a week. If you see it, you see it. If you miss it, you miss it. I mean,
exactly.
We were getting VCRs by then, so
yeah. I had it, but the only thing speaking of soap operas, the only thing I ever VCR'd at that time mm-hmm. was probably either movies, old movies that I really wanted to catch, or soap operas, because I had this community of friends who were fans of a certain soap opera, a couple soap operas, and mm-hmm. so I would VCR them, and then I would get in the Usenet news groups, and we would talk about them, because community and television go together, in my opinion.
Yes, they
and
do.
I never did that with Voyager. I couldn't tell, like, I remember when TNG was on, because it was on Sunday nights. It was the last thing we did before getting to sleep and going to work the next day, but I couldn't for the life of me tell you when Voyager was on. It was not appointment for me, and had I known that when it was on, I might have like taken the trouble to I never felt about Voyager the way I felt about Deep Space Nine, that I just couldn't connect to it. Mm-hmm. I tried watching Deep Space Nine again later, and I don't dislike it, but I don't like it as well. And I did attempt to start watching DS9 when it came on, and I think I just sort of walked away from it the way you do when something bores you a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe that affected my choice about Voyager, but I think it was more just that there was other stuff going on in
my
life. Because had I watched, and I know the early seasons of Voyager get some criticism, I actually like some of the first season a lot, and I would have stuck with it. I really would have had I been in a position to do it.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to me now. So I got a cold, you know, like a bad cold at some point, and I was like Netflix surfing. I think that's what it was. And I was like, oh, I should look at this Star Trek series I haven't really watched. And then it was like, you know, 2 weeks later, haven't moved from the couch. Like, oh my God, I watched the whole thing. A few years later, it was when we started App Camp for Girls, and that was exciting, but also very stressful. And I would always be up till midnight, you know, during a session, trying to make sure we had everything ready for the next day. And at night, I would be like, let me just watch Voyager. And it was the perfect choice, because I would always be like, Janeway, what would Janeway do? That's what you should do.
That's not a bad way to live your life.
No, certainly as a leader of a crew.
Yeah.
And, but then, you know, I got interested in making this Voyager episode guide, because I felt like people were not taking Voyager seriously enough as something good to watch, and just to kind of like, you know, document numerically that there are a lot of excellent episodes of Voyager. And then after that, I was like, well, I guess I could do a podcast too. So that's how.
It's natural evolution. You certainly have to do a podcast. I mean, that's certainly true of me. It's like, what am I going to do with all this old movie knowledge I have? I know, I'll turn it into a show.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, between making the episode guide, which is a spreadsheet, and there's a link in the show notes to it, and also now prepping for the podcast on a regular basis, I've become more and more aware of like sort of the texture of the series over time, and things that I thought were terrible, I realized like they were really small bits in certain seasons and not necessarily the first or second season, you know? I just forgot, you know, that, well, you don't see those terrible Kazon. They're not even in the first season, you know? They're really only second season aliens. It just seems like they go on forever. but this episode that we're watching today is for our homework, and I suppose we could talk about what we are getting into today, is in the fourth season. And I actually went back and watched a few bits of the other previous episodes, because this one that we're watching today, which is called Revulsion, it's episode 5 in season 4, harks back to some things that have happened earlier. And it also is setting up something that will happen later. And I thought, wait a second, Voyager never does this, you know. things like are usually quite self-contained, but in this episode, and we could talk about it a little bit more in detail when we get into it. So, you know, looking over the whole fourth season, you know, list of episodes, I thought, man, this is a great season. I thought season 5 was my favorite, but season 4 is really great. And then, I was looking at 3 a little bit, and I'm like, and 3 is good too. I mean,
you just like Voyager is what you're saying.
I do like Voyager, but I think there are a lot of strong seasons. I would say 2 is my least favorite, and it's not just because of the Kazon. Yeah.
There are good episodes in it. I mean, if
yes.
you ignore the Kazons, but
yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you and I were talking about casting around for something that we both really like about Voyager, and we landed on B'Elanna Torres, and Tell me about your fandom of B'Elanna Torres a little bit.
So I've never been a particular fan of Klingons, although I will say that the way Worf evolved in TNG, I thought he was really well written, and I thought mm-hmm. the way the character grew was super interesting. But I never learned Klingon. I never bought Batliff or anything like that. So thinking about B'Elanna as a Klingon, except that there are other episodes where we get a lot about her backstory and we learn sort of how her Klingon heritage impacts the person she mm-hmm. is. But that seems less important to me than the way I think I first noticed her because of her relationship with Janeway, mm-hmm. which a lot of people think about as mother-daughter. And I get that. But to be honest, I shipped him a little bit.
A ton of people ship Seven and Janeway, but
that's different animal entirely. That's... And I get it, especially since those people didn't apparently get along very well.
I know.
That's like a different mind. That's a different mind space. Yeah. I think B'Elanna, whatever relationship B'Elanna and Janeway have, whether it's mother-daughter or a relationship or sisters or whatever, I just think it's great. And I think the actresses handle it really well.
Yes.
It's well written. And so that's kind of where I became aware of her. And the fact that she's just a badass engineer. Like she
yes.
is always technically sharp, but she has a personality. She's not a robot. She's not a Vulcan. She's not a artificial being. She's a human being who, in fact, gets in trouble sometimes for being aggressive mm-hmm. and displaying those traits that are supposed to be Klingon. She seems like the person who is struggling with the sort of dichotomy of different, you know, being of two races, but is more focused on the human part of herself. Like the Klingon part of herself is absolutely relevant, but except where in specific episodes where she sort of goes off and we learn about her backstory, like in this episode, the fact that she's Klingon is irrelevant, even though she's mm-hmm. like a major part of this. I mean, if there was a Bechdel test for Klingon-ness, she would pass in this episode. I was just thinking about that because there's that column in your spreadsheet about
right Bechdel,
but yeah, so like. I don't like her because she isn't more Klingon, but I do find it fascinating that they've integrated a character where her Klingon-ness is not what she's mainly about. And where there mm-hmm. there, I mean, Star Trek Voyager has multiple strong women, which is one of the reasons that we like it. And mm-hmm. you have, before Seven comes, you have Janeway and you have B'Elanna, and then Seven shows up and, you know, all hell breaks loose, I guess. But, I enjoy watching her. I enjoy feeling like, just as most chief engineers in Star Trek stories, that's a person who manages to bring the crew through, you know, teching the tech, as they say. Mm-hmm. But I just like her humanity on top of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I have always admired her, and I've always enjoyed, you know, seeing her and Janeway, because Janeway is not an engineer. She's a science officer by training, but obviously the two overlap greatly, that she, the two of them have these discussions about engineering topics and help each other out in engineering. And that's one of the reasons that Star Trek Voyager does pass the Bechdel-Wallace test so frequently, way more than anything else, pretty much not just of Star Trek, where, you know, the very low bar is that there's two women, named characters, talking with each other about a topic that is not men. And so if the captain and the chief engineer are both women, you better get a lot of conversations that are not about men, or else the ship is doomed.
But the way they communicate is so direct. And I think that's mm-hmm. why you notice the relationship, because it's not just a sort of like a make it so, get the, you know, more power to the shields kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. B'Elanna, what do you think? And then Janeway says, well, have you thought about this? And B'Elanna goes, well, yeah, that's one thing we could try. But what about this other thing? They're actually having a meeting of the minds. And you're right. They're using their different skill sets because Janeway isn't an engineer, but she trusts B'Elanna. And mm-hmm. I think correct me if I'm wrong. I noticed that Janeway calls her B'Elanna, and normally, I would be upset by that. I would be like, why is she not Lieutenant Torres or whatever? But when Janeway does it, I find it very endearing. And what I can't remember is if most of the rest of the crew calls her by her first name or not.
They all call her by B'Elanna. I think hardly anyone calls her Torres unless there's some like official, you know, bureaucracy speak going on. It bothers me, and I do it, you know. I try, like,
My theory is that for some reason it's easier and more interesting to say B'Elanna, that Torres, like, if you're saying that as a line, Lieutenant Torres, somehow it seems like it might be harder for the actor. I mean, that's not an excuse.
No, I'm going to be paying more attention to this in the future now that you have mentioned it as well, because I mean, they definitely do. Sometimes they call Harry, and
Tom does, like his friends do.
Yeah,
but he's Ensign Kim, or I don't know if he's Kim. Like, if nobody, people don't run down the hall going Kim, you know, it's Harry or it's Ensign Kim. Or
I mean, does Neelix even have a first/last name?
I don't think so.
We've never heard
Tuvok
it.
Tuvok is the same, right?
So, yeah.
Anyway, that's a rabbit hole we could go down. Or Chakotay either, for that matter.
Yeah, well, anyway, I think it would be sort of interesting to follow, but I'm not making a spreadsheet out of that.
Good plan. I'm done.
Yeah, so we said, you know, that, yes, we're both interested in B'Elanna, and you also mentioned the Doctor, which, of course, a great character and well-beloved. And then you picked this episode that we have for this this week's homework, which is Revulsion from Season 4, Episode 5, which is a good B'Elanna and Doctor episode. And I was like, why didn't I think of that? You know, I mean, you said, you before we start recording, you mentioned there were two-parters, and there are definitely some good, there's a good two-parter about holograms in the seventh season, I think it is. It's, you know, B'Elanna and the Doctor are involved pretty heavily. But this, I remember this episode, speaking of something else we were talking about before the recording started, horror. this episode definitely has a horror element to it, but I always remember it mainly because of the strength of the story that lies on the guest star who plays another hologram, or as he calls himself, an isomorphic projection. His name is Leland Orser, and he's one of those like actors you see in everything. I went through IMDb and started, you know, like, cause I'm like, I know I've seen him in like a bunch of stuff, and I made a little list. And then I actually, after I watched the Star Trek episode, I was like, let's have a little Leland Orser festival. And I watched him on Law and Order and on CSI and on NYPD Blue. I did not watch, like, maybe, you know, I didn't watch the entire episodes necessarily. But I think, you know, this performance in Revulsion should be, you know, how in IMDb they say, like, known for. He should be known for this. Because
he's
really
good in it.
He's good in everything else, but this is an incredibly good and intense performance of a hologram who is breaking down literally and mentally
about it. And I must say, I like performances like that where you have an actor who's playing somebody that's on the edge of something or is unstable in some way, and they hold it together until they don't. Mm-hmm. When they're falling apart, they're not chewing scenery. It's really kind of internally focused, and there's a lot of control
in
the way he plays it, if that makes any sense. Like, his character is unstable, but he's like completely in control of it. And that's so amazing to watch, and I would imagine really hard to do for an actor.
Yeah. This one, you know, has always been one of my, maybe not my top episodes ever of Voyager, but definitely on the spreadsheet I've rated it a must watch.
That's, I mean, yeah. I couldn't decide that there were several B'Elanna episodes that were two-parters and some that focused on, you know, sort of her backstory, which I was wanting to look at actually. But I'm really glad I landed here with the help of your spreadsheet, because as you say, it's both B'Elanna and the Doctor. And it's B'Elanna just kind of doing her job. Like, she's mm-hmm. not, it's not about, let's have exposition about how difficult her life is or has been, or bring somebody yeah. back from her past that makes her miserable. Or, as in the first episode I watched when I was trying to decide which one to watch, I know, let's basically possess her. You know, I hate those mm-hmm. kinds of, let's take a woman and let's, you know, possess mm-hmm. her by some creature.
Which episode is that? Oh. The one with
three.
Yes.
Remember.
Oh, remember.
Where she's getting
the memories. Yeah.
She's getting the memories of somebody else, which the performance is, well, not to talk too much about an episode we're not talking about, but the performance is great. I give the actress a great deal of credit, but it just reminds me of the TNG story where Troy is like inhabited by another person, and she's just basically emotionally, you know, crippled by the fact that somebody else is inhabiting her body. And they only do that to women, weirdly enough. So I was happy to watch this one where B'Elanna is just like doing her job and trying to figure out what makes this isomorphic creature tick. And, you know, there's a little action in it because she gets attacked. The Doctor, everybody does great.
Everybody gets like, yeah. And it has one of the best cold opens, I would say, where, you know, you see a ship. It's not a ship you recognize. And then, you know, they go onto the deck and there's a guy sitting there and he doesn't look too well. And then from off camera, somebody's dragging him away by his feet and you see all this blood behind his head. And then it's like, that's the horror part. And the guy who's been dragging him along is now cleaning up. You know, he's kind of a clean freak too. And and at some point his image starts to flicker, and that's when we know he's not an organic. He is a hologram. And he sends an SOS. And the SOS is like, I'm all alone. You know, somebody help me. And it's like, oh, poor guy. Except we, you know, the viewer know that there wasn't an accident on the ship. Well, we don't know. Maybe we don't. Like, I'm trying to remember.
I don't think we know who caused the whatever happened on
the
ship. We don't.
Yeah.
But my question, I mean, and not to jump too far ahead, but my question is, before he meets B'Elanna and the Doctor, which he will eventually, mm-hmm. what was his end goal? Like, he doesn't want, I guess he wants to be taken off this ship that he's by himself on. He's mm-hmm. he's not, and he identifies himself as an isomorphic mm-hmm. being. So what does he want? And whoever he expects to respond, they're going to be more organic beings. And given what we learn about him and his feelings toward organic beings, did mm-hmm. he have malintent toward them, or does he just want to get off the ship and create some sort of new life for himself? We never find that out, but I'm just curious.
I think like the implication of that setup is that he probably would be fine on his own, except that he is, you know, his program is failing. So it's basically he's dying, you know, holographically, unless somebody fixes his matrix or whatever.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but I guess you're right, because, yeah, there is a large part of the plot that's like, yeah, we need to fix you.
Yeah.
And I don't know, because they make and again, sorry if I'm jumping forward, but they make a big deal about the Doctor's mobile emitter being important in order for him to get off the ship. Does this guy have mm-hmm. a mobile emitter? Can he get off the ship?
I don't know. No, the Doctor's he's unique among holograms from, I think, you know, that we meet that have this ability to have the mobile emitter, which, so, you know, that sort of segues into another topic, because when we come back after the credits, it's a very kind of jarring moment where Paris and Kim are making fun of Tuvok, they're roasting him, like, a, you know, it's a classic kind of like celebration that's a roast. And Janeway, you know, is laughing. Everybody's laughing except Tuvok, of course. And then she says, but, you know, I rely on him 100% ever since, you know, that first day I met him and he turned me in for breaking the rules. But he was right. And it's a promotion ceremony for Tuvok, and he gets promoted to lieutenant commander. So there's that, like, kind of out of the context of the actual show we're watching. We don't know why Tuvok got promoted exactly. Maybe he just got promoted. I don't actually know why. Then, like, the party breaks up. Chakotay goes to Kim and says, I'm assigning you to work on the astrometrics lab, and I want you to have Seven work with you. So there is an astrometrics lab upgrade B-plot in this show, but it is also the astrometrics lab becomes like a major part of the show going forward. And so I was like, oh yeah, so this is where they got started. And then they show Paris and B'Elanna together where they're like, you know, they're awkward with each other. And he's like, I know it's been a couple of days and we haven't talked to each other. And, you know, you said you loved me. And she's like, yes, I did. But, you know, you don't have to say it back. And then there's a smooch. And it was like, oh. And I thought, okay, cool. This is the first smooch of Paris and B'Elanna. And I actually went back and looked at the episode, which was called Day of Honor. Well, I mean, they had an attraction going before, but Day of Honor is when they got stuck together, almost, you know, dying out in space from suffocation. So I was like, okay, now I'm remembering, you know, but of course that's going to be a major plot thread for the next, till the end of the series. And then if that weren't enough, so we got like, there's a Tuvok thing, there's astrometrics and Kim and B'Elanna. And then the doctor says, hey, you know, now that Kes is gone, so Kes had left, and yeah, if you started with this episode, you'd think this was a soap opera. The character Kes has left not too long ago, and said, I have to recruit somebody, you know, to be my medical assistant, and the most qualified person, unfortunately, is you. And so, well, Paris is like medical assistant for the rest of the series as well. And it's always a thorn in his side because, of course, he loves being a pilot. And he loves, you know, doing all his away missions and stuff like that, as well as his various holodeck creative ventures. But he's, you know, he's always going to be roped back into being in sick bay, you know, taking him away from the things he really wants to do for the rest of the series. So that is, those are, you know, just like many threads. That's very unusual for episodic.
And we're not even show. 10 minutes in.
Right. And then the mobile emitter, the doctor has just gotten this in a two-parter called Future's End, which I highly recommend. I wouldn't call it like, oh my God, the best Voyager episodes. It's just one of the most fun. Involves time travel and, you know, it involves everybody. It's one of those things like, let's take the crew on kind of a vacation. It's not, they're not literally on a vacation, but they go on a wacky away mission. Let's put it that way.
The people, the actors and the crew, the writers, something different to do. And I usually, every once in a while, I don't like those, but I generally speaking enjoy those kinds of episodes a lot.
Anyway, yeah, at some point I need to rewatch Future's End. But he gets this thing, it's technology from the future, and it was very key piece of technology for the writers of Star Trek Voyager, because they had already kept the doctor confined to sick bay, basically, for the first three seasons. And they needed to be able to let him roam around. So, yep, he wants to go. He sees that that SOS from the isomorph, and he's like, let's go, I'll go help him, he's one of my kind. And he said, and Janeway's like worried. She's worried about this mobile emitter. It's kind of like, you just got your mobile emitter. Don't, you know, you think like you got to be careful with it or whatever. Don't wreck
first
it.
She's like, whoa. I didn't give you promotion. What is this? You're not telling, you know, we haven't decided.
Yeah,
he
was very, very bossy.
He was. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I mean, all of the sort of setup that doesn't, well, the B plot with Harry and Seven is a full on plot, but the other stuff with Tuvok and then with even Paris and B'Elanna getting together, there's no real payoff in the rest of the episode for that. Mm-mm. That's like long term setup, and as such, if you're just watching that episode by itself, it's kind of a weird way to start. And because you have two relationships, quote unquote, getting started, two attractions getting started, one of which is, you know, moved forward in the B plot, and the other of which is not really relevant at all, except to the extent, and I love this, that the doctor is like teasing B'Elanna.
Yes.
She's like, I wonder what Paris's bedside manner would be like. And it's hilarious. Yeah. The doctor is such a snarky character anyway. And he just gives B'Elanna crap. And it's so funny.
I mean, he definitely has his moments of behaving immaturely. And that is one of them, like, sure, you know, needling her about, you know, I mean, making innuendos, like, even
and
like
basically
that.
Saying, I know, even though this has just happened, he's like, I know exactly what's going on. Because, of course, he's in close proximity to them. You know, Paris is working with him, which I do think is kind of a weird decision. I don't know why they put him in sick bay. That seems odd. But in any case, so the doctor is aware, because even though he's a hologram, he's pretty fully realized in terms of understanding human behavior and kind of like, I see how you looked at her or him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The doctor is kind of a built-in stalker, because he not only sees things, he registers vital signs and things like that.
Oh, there's that. Yeah, I forgot about that part. Like, your hormones, your heart rate are elevated.
Yeah. But yeah, so the two of them are on a shuttle, and they go to this unnamed ship, I think. And they're looking around. They can't find anybody. Again, another horror moment inserts itself, which is the isomorph appearing like behind them. And it's like, it's right behind you.
It's all very dark in there, of course.
It's very dark. And he's picking up a hammer, and then, I mean, picking up a hammer pretty much gives away that he is the accident, quote, that happened on this ship. But in one sentence, B'Elanna says something that, you know, about him, about the doctor, you know, acknowledging that he's a hologram, and the isomorph disappears, the hammer drops to the ground, and it's like, again, a little horror-like. But then he appears, and he's like, yeah, it's me. Thank you. You know, he's very like, I'm sorry. He apologizes so much. I'm sorry for if I, you know, startled you. And so they, you know, they meet him. They're like, not quite sure what to make of him, but the doctor's so enthusiastic about being able to talk to another hologram.
So is the hologram. Like, he's yeah. He never expected, which is why, I mean, we know he's a bad dude pretty quickly, but I just feel for the hologram too. Like, he never expected that whatever rescue he was going to have would entail meeting another hologram, and somebody who's fully realized he's got the mobile emitter. He's in a professional relationship with this organic, and he's going to be the one that's going to save his quote unquote life. So yeah. For both of them, there's a great exchange of information and just sort of like, wow, I see somebody like me.
Well, you know, one thing I definitely realized, like, in watching the doctor this episode, that kind of congealed for me is like, wherever the doctor goes, he is like the model slash metaphor of, like, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Like, oh, you know, you feel limited by your little closet you have to live in, and you know, go study art, go study music. You know, it's like he's like the ultimate, like, you know, liberal education representative on the show. And I mean, not that I have anything against art and music, but a guy who has spent his whole existence in a closet cleaning reactor, you know, waste is probably not, needs something like more basic first before they go off and become a composer and a poet and an actor and an opera singer like the Doctor.
Yeah, but I think too, I mean, that's, to be honest, that is something you see a lot in somebody who has achieved some sort of attainment.
Exactly.
Whether it's culturally or professionally, they're like, well, if I could do it, why can't you? And right. They're not taking into account that the reason that they did that in the first place was because of some emptiness in their life. And they said, well, I need to do something about it. And they found a way. And the way mm-hmm. that he found, the Doctor found, might never be this guy's way. And I was going to say, too, that what I liked about the way the Doctor talks about who he is now is that he also references his beginnings and how hard he had to work to get what he believed were his rights and privileges as a member of the crew and to gain mm-hmm. respect. And I think episodic TV sometimes has a hard time verbalizing that there was a past. You know, you sometimes mm-hmm. hint at it in content of the story, but to have a character actually say, yeah, things were really different from me before and now they're better, which mm-hmm. creates a point of connection between the Doctor and the other guy, but it also reminds us, yes, and if you remember the first season when every time the Doctor showed up, he's like, what's your emergency? And he was literally confined to sickbay and nobody took him seriously and his own personality didn't necessarily help with that. And he has, and I think Robert Picardo does a great job there too. Like, he takes that moment mm-hmm. and he's sort of quiet about it. And I think he's being reflective at that moment. Like, but he starts out going, you know, you ought to take up painting and sculpture. And then he's like, yeah, it was kind of hard for me in season one. Season one kind of sucked for me.
Yeah. So, you know, it's definitely the Doctor has advanced so far, he's kind of forgotten if he ever knew, like, exactly, like, how it felt to be way, you know, under the foot. I mean, people were rude to him. And yes, they didn't, they sometimes left his program on running in sick bay, but they did not, like, keep him locked in a closet and never come visit him. Of course, he was the Doctor, but yeah, I mean, he didn't have it quite as bad as this poor isomorph.
No.
Who you feel sorry for. You know, obviously, if this were a human being, like, and he had been treated this way, you would expect him to be
well, it's unclear how he was treated and how he internalized it. Like, the people mm-hmm. he was working for may have taken him for granted and treated him badly, mm-hmm. or it may be that because his program is malfunctioning, his perception, because, I mean, the way he talks mm-hmm. about,
well, that's true,
is like, oh my God, you eat and that's disgusting. And I clean up and that's disgusting. And you have sex and that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And they may or may not have been terrible to him. I mean, no. I don't think we know that. And I kind of don't think it matters, because his problems seem to be based on the fact that he's kind of broken. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that humans, I don't think he was tortured. I could be wrong, but I don't think we're meant to be.
I don't think, like, tortured, but, you know, but not, I mean,
not taken seriously, or given the opportunity to grow. I mean, that's probably fair.
Or needed, you know, allowed to roam around the ship, because why would they need him to do that if he had just right. this one job?
Right. That goes back to the Doctor, who, as you say, was not locked in a closet, but he was either in sick bay or he had to be summoned to appear. There's an episode mm-hmm. where, I can't remember which one it was, I think it's from the first season, where, like, everybody is gone from the ship and the Doctor is somehow mm-hmm. is summoned, his program summons him, and he's there, and, like, he has to, and he finally finds somebody else. But I thought that was fascinating, because he was still, like, really restricted in his movements and his capabilities, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I wish I remember the name of the episode. I'm very bad at that.
I wonder if it's the one, okay, like one of my all-time favorites is the two-parter called Basics, where the rest of the crew gets like abandoned on a planet and the Kazon take over the ship. And the only ones left on the ship are the Doctor and this one Betazoid named Suter, who was in the brig for having murdered somebody. And so Suter is a psychotic Betazoid, which is very handy to have if you're... anyway, that actor, I thought of it earlier when we were talking about Leland Orser, is that actor is Brad Dourif, who is an amazing actor and has been around for quite a while. He was one of the main characters, kind of the main character after the big nurse and McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Uh-huh. He was Billy Bibbit, and he was a little young man.
Steady, deep trivia right there.
Yes. He was also what's his name in Grima Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings. He's very good at giving you the
creepy, scary,
the kind of little bit scary. I mean, of course, Billy Bibbit was just a messed up young man, but he's really good. That anyway, I recommend whoever has not watched Basics, you should watch it because it's going to come up on this podcast sooner or later. I will con somebody into watching it with
me. You probably won't have much trouble convincing somebody to watch it because it's the one I'm thinking of. It's a great one.
Yeah, it was like, you know, we're a hologram and a sociopath, you know, against the Kazon. So, yeah. So eventually, I mean, the isomorph ends up, you know, attacking B'Elanna because she's figured out, like, oh, there's all these murdered people on this ship. And she is definitely, again, it's like a horror movie that, like, talking to a crazy serial killer, how she talks to him that way. And she does get badly injured, but she doesn't get killed. And she keeps coming back. So I was like,
she has a doctor around to help with that.
Right.
All the injuries, that's the thing about Star Trek, is all the injuries sound just terrible. And then the doctor is like, oh, I can fix that. It's fine. It's like Harry Potter. It's like magic, you know? It's
just... Yeah. No, it's true. As I've been saying a lot, especially this year, like I used to want a transporter or a replicator, but now all I want is the sick bay. With an EMH. But yeah, so the doctor, you know, and the isomorph have, you know, like his eyes are finally open. Like, no, B'Elanna was right. He's not just like a little bit off because of how the experience that he's had. He's a homicidal maniac isomorph. And I thought the doctor, I forgot like quite how it ended because I haven't watched in a while. And I thought, oh, the doctor will get him. But I was very happy to see in the end it was B'Elanna plus engineering that got rid of the isomorph.
Yeah, because and we think he's gone at one point and then he's not.
Right.
And then we have to kill him again.
That's super. That's also Haunted House.
Thing, yeah.
And actually, he's, you know, going back to Lord of the Rings, he had created his own isomorphic fish, and he's like, fish, they're so clean, they're, you know,
delicious.
They're like fish, you know, but
he's a germaphobe, which is just sort of an interesting random. It's kind of a random character trait. I guess it is something that is seen in folks who have some disorders. I don't want to stereotype anyone, but I mean, it's an interesting extra bit. Like it's a character bit that you don't really need, but that makes him even more interesting.
Right. And of course, like now we can, add to the collection, of tropes, Chekhov's live wire, because we see the live wire earlier, and Vlana prevents the isomorph from getting destroyed with it, and of course she gets to use it in the end. But yeah, I really, it's a good ending. I have many questions still about how holograms actually work. That is beyond the scope of this podcast, I would say. I need a physicist or something. I don't understand how they can hit us, but we can't hit them. But that's all. I don't want to dig up in the rabbit hole for that.
That's
You don't have to.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of things I don't understand about. I mean, I know that holograms have. I mean, they can have emotions. They can have drives. They can have it's interesting the rule, because they're not. You know, they made a big deal about. They usually make a big deal about either Vulcans or synthetic beings not being emotional creatures. You know, Data famously wasn't until he was. But holograms aren't constrained by such limitations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Apparently, according to the Voyager stories. But, and then, this was the main part of the show. Okay, here's one thing about B'Elanna Torres in this episode that I thought was pretty cool, was she was, like, super professional, not annoyed, not losing her temper with anyone. You know, that's often the way that she's, you know,
right.
They animate her, is that, like, you can't cross her. She'll bite your head off.
Which is why I was saying that, like, her Klingonness was not a thing, and her quote-unquote flaws were not a thing. But at the same time, she wasn't just being a functionary. Like, a lot of times on an away mission, if you have several people, there's one or two protagonists and the rest of them are sort of there to fetch and carry or to do things or to be talked to. There's got to be, I don't know what the name of it would be, but I always say that there are always characters in entertainment or literature or whatever that exist so that the main character can talk to them. But B'Elanna is not doing any of that. Like she's full on doing her job, and she's actually like less sort of focused and intense than she often is on the Enterprise, and I think part of it on the Enterprise. Where does she work? She works on the Voyager.
Everybody knows what you meant.
Yeah, thank you. I had to correct myself before you or one of your delightful listeners felt the need to do it. Who is that person you had on the show that doesn't even know what ship we're talking about?
Right in the title.
She's right. It is, and it's right on the episode even. But she's just like, she's doing her job, and she's doing it at a volume level that makes sense given the surroundings. And
yeah.
I liked the performance, and I liked I especially liked the way it was written. Because you could have chosen any quote organic. It didn't even have to be a woman. It didn't have to be a half Klingon. It could have been Harry, except he's busy with Seven. It could have been Tom. I mean, but it was B'Elanna. And the reason that they had her go was so that she could keep an eye on the Doctor's mobile emitter, which gives them some character connection, which I like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she's constantly pulling out a screwdriver to that mobile emitter throughout the series.
Right.
Always adjusting it. But yeah, and as you alluded to, there's a B plot. It's Kim and Seven getting to know each other. And I think it's important to, you know, remember this is pretty early in Seven's time on Voyager, and so she's more Borg-like than she, you know, that's part of the stories.
You
have to laugh when she's going like, comfort is irrelevant, beauty is irrelevant, and then of course like the $10 million line, are you in love, then you wish to copulate. Take off your clothes. I mean, that used to kind of make me cringe more than it did this time, because I thought, for the first time, I thought, Seven is totally, you know, calling Harry's bluff and showing him, like, the ultimate conclusion of his, like, meandering around, being nice and smiley and all that, and asking her dumb questions, you know?
Like, right, she's just getting to the point. She's like, look, what do you want?
But I think, like, it was, like, intentionally, you know, it was less Borg, like and more like yeah. seven like to say,
right?
I think I know how to get this guy off my back.
My other favorite line in that scene is when she comes to Harry's quarters and he goes, "You weren't regenerating, were you?" I love that. No, I wasn't. I could have been, but I wasn't.
Yeah, it was funny. Anyway, I think it's there are other plots with Seven that make me cringe more than this one.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, there's many that I really like, but I thought it was funny, and it certainly gave Harry Kim a showcase for his Harry Kim-ness.
That's true, and you know, whatever you think of Harry, there are. I think the critique of that character is that he's not always very well used. Like he's kind of mm-hmm. in the background, and they kind of don't give him good things to do, and that's why we make fun of him. But in this episode, like he got to have motivation, and he may have been an awkward guy, probably not able to handle Seven. Like if she had mm-hmm. just. You know, grabbed him and said, "All right, let's do this thing." I don't know that he would have been up to it, but
yeah.
it gave him a reason to be in the episode, and it sort of made him say, "Okay, yeah, she called his bluff." I think that's the perfect way of putting it.
Yeah. So that was enjoyable. And then my last comment about this that's going to bug me for the first time, and I'm never going to be able to stop seeing it, is that there's that final bit between Chakotay and Kim about the assignment and astrometrics, but it starts with Chakotay getting a glass of water from the replicator, and then he puts it right on the console.
Oh no!
Without a place, you know, what do you call it?
No coaster or whatever.
No coaster. No, nothing.
I mean,
and I'm like,
how long has he been working on starships? Come on, dude.
Maybe they're
do stuff like that.
Maybe they're completely waterproof and it's not even a consideration in the 24th century.
If Belana was there, she would not be okay with that.
It just was like, what? Right. I mean, I was impressed with him drinking water. You know, I was like, we should all drink more water, but... But then, you know,
he's not an Earl Grey hot kind of guy. He just drinks water.
Yeah. This is a coffee show, by the way. We don't do Earl Grey, just so you know.
Fair enough. I'm on board. I had espresso this morning, if you can tell. I'm
yeah, me too. But Janeway only drinks coffee black. So
my hero.
Yeah.
Another reason to like Janeway.
I know. Well, Shelley, it's been... just delightful to chit-chat with you this episode and talk about Star Trek Voyager and B'Elanna and isomorphs and all of the fun things that we get to enjoy being Star Trek fans and especially Star Trek Voyager fans. And it's just always interesting for me to get some new insight from somebody else. So thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for sort of making me pick an episode. And I chose well, which I guess I tried one and didn't work out. The second time around was a good choice, so I appreciate your making me dig around in the Voyager lexicon and finding one that was really fun. Uh-huh. To talk about.
Great. And thank you, listeners, for being here. You can find Voyager Revisited online at VoyagerCast.com. Follow us on Twitter at Voyager_cast. If you like this podcast, you'll want to check out all the other great shows at TheIncomparable.com and even consider becoming a member, which gets you access to bonus episodes, bootlegs, and our special members-only Slack, where you can find me chatting about all things Star Trek with the other podcasters and fans. I will be back in a couple of weeks with another guest to discuss Star Trek Voyager. Until then, time's up.